Hey, everybody, it's Jackie. And on January 23rd, Steve and I will celebrate our 37th anniversary. That is a long time. And I thought it might be fun for us to reflect on our marriage and discuss some ideals about marriage and how marriage has evolved over the years, not just ours, but throughout history. And I got to be honest, I shared the questions that I wanted to ask Steve with him earlier, but he would not tell me what his answers were. So I have no idea where this is going, but here we go. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
This is fun.
I know.
We get to share everything. We get to share your podcast, colds, everything.
That's right. We're both dealing with a cold right now. But so you know me. You know I love to research all kinds of things pertaining to women and faith. And over the years, I've shared with you things that I've learned, both culturally, cultural perspectives, insights from the scripture about marriage and actually how marriage has developed. And one of my favorite resources is a book titled Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. And it's by Stephanie Kuntz. And in her book, she shares this story that I have shared with you, Steve, that I find particularly captivating, if not hilarious. And it's about this small-scale society in Sri Lanka. And there they have this unique marriage tradition. And this is what it is. If a woman prepares a meal for a man and he eats it, then they're married. And if they decide to get divorced, guess what happens? She simply stops cooking him a meal. And when I read that, I was like, what? And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. That might be just brilliant. And so that made me think about cooking and food and marriage. And when you and I got married, I was 22 and I really didn't know how to cook. And I remember you telling me that you loved potatoes. And so I made potatoes in just about every way possible. And finally, one day you said to me, I said I like potatoes, but like I don't want them every single night. And then we argued. Do you remember this? We argued about tomato soup.
We didn't argue. I mean, you argued. I knew what I was right on. And Campbell's tomato soup should be made with milk. That's no brainer.
That is what you told me. And you even said, my mother made it with milk. By the way, young men who are about to get married, you should never say to your new bride, my mother. So I walked over, pulled off a can of Campbell's soup out of the cupboard and showed you on the back of it. And it said water.
Yeah. For those not aware of the proper way, they had to have that.
Or maybe those who couldn't afford milk. But yeah. It just made me think of, you know, cooking has always been kind of an important part of our family. And during the pandemic, you got a little bored and you're very creative. And so you started taking over cooking. And I don't think I've cooked a meal in the last 5 years. So talk to us about cooking and how that's come about over the last 5 years and where you are with that right now.
Yeah, I always like to cook, but I think during the pandemic, working from home, being in the same room together, it was just nice to have a break, a certain time of day, could move to something else. And we kind of needed a rhythm of moving to something else. So I just started cooking and I'm enjoying it a lot. Last night, I actually made what I think was a fabulous meal, a rissa chicken with dates and shallots and a little yogurt and dill, and it was...
And oranges.
And orange peels, yeah. It was pretty remarkable.
It was fabulous.
And then a lemon olive oil cake to follow
it up. It was superb. We have now moved from calling you Steve to Chef Stefan when you move into the kitchen. And it's like a chef appears and it like becomes this whole thing and you better get out of his way. And I do remember during the pandemic, we would have people in occasionally or we would eat outside with people and, you know, they would ooh and ah over your food and they would say things to you like, wow, have you always cooked like this? And it used to really piss me off. So finally, one day, remember I said to you, I was like, you know, I cooked for the first 30 years of our marriage, and I cooked when we had a budget.
You did all the hard cooking.
I had to cook for kids, you know, on a budget. And I said, not once in 30 years did somebody ask me if I did all the cooking, you know?
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, I'd just like to have a little credit. And you have been so kind and gracious about that. You have, every time now that comes up about your cooking, you have been very gracious to point, yes, I'm an excellent cook and you are a better cook than I am, but you have given me credit for the hard work I did with the 30 years with the kids. And I appreciate that.
I mean, it's way easier to cook when you aren't really thinking about the budget when you decide what to cook.
Right. Or whether everybody's going to like it or not.
Or what everybody's going to like, or it's on a schedule, you know, we got to get it in between soccer practice and youth group or whatever. So yeah, there's no question.
Yeah.
Different ballgame.
So you grew up in a conservative evangelical, we might even say at some points in your parents' family life, it was maybe even fundamentalist, but you grew up in that type of home, and I didn't. So we have some different backgrounds, and I would love to hear from you. What did you learn about marriage from your parents and your faith upbringing?
I don't know that I don't really remember learning too much about marriage from the church itself, but I did from my parents. Some positive things, you know, like my dad, I don't remember how, because he wasn't really a big teacher kind of father, but, you know, when we got married, I was pretty committed that you don't go to bed on a fight or an argument or angry, you stay until that's resolved. And I think that was really helpful in the early stages when you were telling me, yes, you were going to make another big potato. I didn't want it.
Oh, we had bigger fights than that.
Yes, we did. So I think that was super helpful. Because I didn't really have any particular views on how to make a marriage work, but that was a big one. I think, and kind of somewhat of a negative, my parents never, ever, ever argued or fought. I just never saw it, never experienced it. And I don't think that's realistic. I don't know if that's just, I don't know if they just avoided those kind of things.
Or they may have done it behind the scenes and you didn't know.
I just never saw it. So when we had arguments, when we got married, I thought something was seriously wrong.
Yeah, I think you even said, I need to go see a psychiatrist.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Which went over really well.
Yeah, that was not one of my finer moments.
And I want to say, you know, I grew up in a family where we fought, you know, but also grew up in a verbally abusive home. And so, you know, fighting for me was about winning. And it was about using words to cut somebody down to their knees, you know.
Yeah, you were way better.
I was way better at it, yeah. But I did, you know, through coming into faith and learning some things through scripture about how to communicate, I did come to a point early in our marriage where I was like, oh, fighting is not about winning. Fighting is about moving toward reconciliation. And that really altered how we did conflict in a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah, I think we've gotten better at it. You know, I didn't experience in our church world, people didn't get divorced. So I didn't really experience that. People were married forever. I mean, most of my parents' friends were just married, you know, and it was not unusual. So I don't know if those were teachings or learnings, but there's just things that I experienced and observed, just like experienced my parents never had an argument.
Right.
But I mean, the main thing I came into, I would say, was turn into arguments, conflict, and work it out. Don't just let it fester.
Yeah.
That was a big one.
Yeah, you've done a great job of that, actually. I think one of the things that's one of your strengths is that you do not avoid conflict, that you are able to walk into conflict. I think it's harder for you to do it with me and with your children, which are your most inner circle, than it is for anybody else.
Yeah.
For you to do it with other people. But you still have good skills in that, you know? So I appreciate that about you. Well, I want to, as we talk a little bit about our marriage, I also want to share a little bit about the history of marriage, because I actually was really surprised as I started digging into different books. Even, you know, the book I just mentioned was written by a woman who's a professor and a historian, but not necessarily a Christian. But I've read Christian books also, like one by Julie Rubio called A Christian Theology of Marriage and Family. These are the books I read, right, Steve?
Sounds so interesting.
And then over coffee, after I've read them, I get to tell you all about them, and you're so patient. Anyway, she explores the cultural and theological development of marriage in early Christians through the writings of our early church fathers up to the modern day. And what I took away from her work is that some of the messages I heard about marriage from my faith community are relatively new ideas in context of human history. And I'm not saying that these contemporary ideas about marriage are bad. However, I do think understanding the historical background helps me discern what to prioritize in my own marriage and what to hold on to more lightly or even tightly. And let me just summarize some of the new ideas that we have about Christian marriage in particular. Most American Christians view marriage as a choice between two people who are in love with each other. Most would hold a religious ceremony officiated by a priest or a minister, including a woman minister like me, and they would also have to obtain a marriage license from the government. For many Catholics, marriage is considered a sacrament that came about in the 1500s. For many Protestants, we would not say it's a sacrament. We would say it's a covenant that also came about in the 1500s. So what I want you to think about is prior to those 1500 years, Christianity did not talk about marriage as a sacrament or a covenant. And I'm not going to go into what those two words mean. You guys can Google it. But many of us listening, I suspect, have heard statements like, marriage is not about happiness, it's about holiness. And that concept came about by Calvin in the 1500s, didn't exist prior. We've heard that marriage helps keep a man from sexual sin. That was something that was taught to me when we got married and I went to church. Got to have sex with your husband so that he'll be faithful. And that concept came from St. Augustine. And we learned from our Christian communities that marriage is the ideal standard. And in many ways, it's kind of become an idol in the conservative evangelical world. And that idea came about from the Puritans in the 1600s. And what I find fascinating about all of those concepts that we hear today were actually established, you know, in the 1500s, 1600-ish. That's a short period of time when we look at all of human history and marriage happening prior to the 1500s. And we think of those things as kind of like, well, that's just biblical. That's just the way it's always been. Well, no, it hasn't always been those thoughts. You know, for millennial, marriages were prearranged by parents. The marriage was for families to build wealth, acquire land, stay out of debt, and often to avoid war, right? So like we might marry off our daughter to a guy who we're at war with, hoping that that marriage will calm down any tensions and we won't have to go to war. So what we see historically throughout time is marriage has been about economics, it's been about politics, and producing an heir. It's not been about two people in love finding their soulmate, you know? So let's talk about when we got married. Let's talk about our parents and marriage, because you and I dated for maybe 3 months, mm-hmm. and then, you know, we got engaged. And it kind of, you know, blew our parents out of the water, I think, a little bit. My mom was concerned that I wouldn't finish college because I was in my last semester of my undergrad, if you remember, at NC State. And little did she know, or I, that, you know, I'd go on to get 4 degrees. But my mom was concerned that I was getting married young. My mom didn't have a great marriage. She wasn't really excited about this. And your mom wasn't much happier, was she?
No, I think, you know, I think your mom had at least heard the rumor that I was a badass. And my mom wanted me to marry a nice Christian girl, you know?
Not a badass. And,
yeah, not a badass. She was not pleased. Yeah.
She was not pleased. And I wanted to say to her, why do you think that your son is attracted to this badass?
Right.
Because he too might be one of those. Little did she know. Yeah. So we've, you know, you and I have had to navigate the mother-in-law situation, particularly my relationship with your mom. And, you know, you are the apple of your mom's eye. Both your brothers would say you were the one she loved the most, favored the most, adored the most. You were the youngest of the three boys. And in some ways, I kind of took her shining star away. And we've not had a very good relationship throughout the years. And I know that you've had to walk some serious tension with really wanting to love me well, but also you really love your mom.
Right.
And how do you call those things out and how do you handle that? So
I didn't do it that well. So don't reach out to me for anybody's advice. I was terrible.
Yeah, but you have wisdom now. You can look back and say, oh, what would you say to a young man getting married?
I would definitely confront that right off the get-go. I mean, sit down, face-to-face conversation. This is the woman I love. This is the reason I love her. And you're going to either need to be 100% for her and us, or we're going to have to limit our relationship. I wish I'd done that super quick. I think my mom would have been better and your relationship would have been much better. I think it was really hard for me. I mean,
you were young. You were 24.
Yeah. I mean, you're young when you get married generally. So, I mean, that's not really an excuse. People make good decisions when they're young too. My mom doesn't do confrontation well. So I kind of avoided it because I had a good relationship with my mother. I don't think I took the time to perceive how it was impacting you. I knew it was, but I don't think I really absorbed that, you know? And so, I mean, if I had any advice, it wouldn't be so much about confronting your mother if she's not treating your spouse well. It's more about being in tune with how is this moment impacting your other half? And I see, you know, marriages that are 10, 15, 20 years into marriage, but I see guys just completely missing the boat on that sometimes. You can just tell that, you know, their wife is sharing something pretty meaningful and pretty painful, and they're not paying attention.
Or they're just not picking up on it. They're not really listening.
Yeah.
They're not asking, why is my wife responding this way? What's happening to my wife?
Whatever the reason is, but those are fabulous moments that if you respond appropriately will help you get through a lot of other stupid decisions, you know? So
yeah.
I know it's busy. It's, you know, we had 3 kids, 3 and under, working 3 jobs, trying to do seminary, all that kind of stuff. And so I think there is a limit to what you can absorb and take in and catch. But if I could have caught that way earlier and adjusted that, I would redo that in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. Let's talk wedding ceremonies. I Googled today, what is the average cost of a wedding in America? $30,000 average. I started panicking, Steve. I'm thinking, oh my God, we got kids that are about to get married sometime in the next future. 2 years or throwing. Like, oh!
Not without 30,000, I can tell you right now.
Yeah, there won't be any 30,000 for my kids.
I don't think they'd want that either.
No, it's true. They probably wouldn't. I would say that's true. But interesting, when you do some research on the history of wedding ceremonies, it's fascinating because ceremonies used to be really, really like simple. They could even be as simple as just saying in front of your parents and the community, I marry you. Or divorce could be as simple as saying it 3 times. I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you.
Wait. That's all it would take?
That's all it would take. Yeah. Because
wow.
There's no government involved, right? It's just the community involved. And so in some of the places, the ceremony, you know, there might be a ceremony, but there definitely was not usually a religious official over the ceremony. There was no requirement or involvement by a government, no paperwork to do. People kind of just went with whatever custom or ritual was part of their society, their village, their people group. And we see this change a little bit when Rome is in power and we have Augustine come to power. And he really like changes marital laws and kind of solidifies some things about marriage. It's because he believed that a stable family meant a secure empire, and that was his motive, you know. So he instituted all these laws encouraging marriage, discouraging infidelity. But we don't want to lose sight that it was all for securing the empire. And he really mostly cared about people in upper social stratus. Like if you try to do research on what marriage was like for people of lower social stratus, like there's very little there because most people didn't care what they were doing. And the benefit of these laws was not about love, was not about a soulmate, was not about individual couple. It was about the family as a whole staying strong so the government could stay strong. And in Rome, as very much, and by the way, we're talking about Rome because that's during Jesus's time. It's also how it is the society in which we have built our theology and philosophy upon, along with some Greek philosophers. But Rome was like a patriarchal society, right? It's where father rules. It doesn't mean that he's part of the family. It means he's over the family. And I don't think people understand how much authority and power fathers had in this society. Like a dad could literally choose to have a newborn child killed. The dad decided who you married, but he also could dissolve those marriages. He could sell off some of his kids to pay off debt. I mean, he had absolute control. And when I think about this, I think, oh man, this is when you really want a dad who's a good guy. Because mm-hmm. otherwise, particularly as a woman, you're in trouble. And it's in this context that we see Paul write about marriage, right? Paul is writing off from a Roman context, a Roman culture, Ephesians 5, 21 through 24. We have, you know, like wives submit to your husbands, husbands, you know, love your wives. And we have, you know, children do this and slaves do that. And we call these the household codes. And they simply reflect like the legal state of affairs under Roman law, whereby the father had absolute power over members in the family. But Paul does something very wild in Ephesians 5. He actually, if you look through the list, he reduces the father's authority and increases the woman's authority. And in that culture, that would have just been like a mind-blowing concept. So let's talk about our wedding ceremony. I was in France,
mm-hmm.
and you remember you called me. We were supposed to get married. We got engaged. I went to France to study.
Yeah, we were going to get married like the year after you got back from France.
Right.
And I said, yeah, I don't want to wait that long. What's the point? So you said, fine, you just got to put the wedding together. Which, I mean, I wasn't that big of a stressor for me, I don't think. I drove around, found a fabulous inn, and booked it. And, you know, that way everything happened at the inn. We You Came Down the Staircase to You Are So Beautiful, Joe Cocker song. The reception was right there. The food was right there. Everything happened right there.
Fabulous food.
Yeah, fabulous food. You didn't have to, you know, people didn't have to run around collecting chairs and all that kind of stuff. I think it was pretty inexpensive altogether. I think maybe our wedding was $5,000.
Five grand, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was fabulously beautiful. You did an excellent job. I didn't have a hand in any of it. You picked up the food, you picked out the place.
Yeah.
And I literally got off the plane from France and did look at you and think, oh my God, I don't really know this man. I'm about to get married. But I went to the mall. I don't know if you remember this, but we were in Syracuse, I think, at this time. And I went to the mall and there was a place called Jacqueline's Bridal. And on the back of the store was a flapper dress and it was $100 and it fit and I bought it. And that's what
that's
I did for my wedding.
$100. Wow.
I did my parents well.
Yeah.
I did my parents well.
I think it was a great wedding. I think our error in hindsight is it was so much put together and so simple that none of our family had any part in putting it together at all. You know, none of our mothers had any role.
Right.
And I don't know if that's bad, but I do think, you know, we missed an opportunity there.
Yeah. My mom's even mentioned that, you know, like, I just thought she didn't want to be involved because she still had children at home. She was working like crazy. And I just thought, well, we'll just, you know, in my mind, we're just making it easy on everybody. But I agree with you. We didn't include
that. And I was in such a rush. I January 23rd in upstate New York is a pretty crazy time to get married.
It's actually a bad time.
Yeah. It turned out to be a cold, but, you know, easy day to drive the roads. But otherwise, it could have been disastrous.
Could have been a disaster, but it wasn't. Well, I want to say two things to our audience. So Steve travels a lot to Africa and you're going to help me here, Steve, but we have a system in our apartment that plays music. What do you call that?
Alexa.
Yeah, Alexa. And so we have, you know, I'll be playing music while Steve's in Africa and you decide to steal the music. And you'll play sometimes, You Are So Beautiful. And I just kind of like, it comes out of nowhere. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so wild.
It's fun.
But I want to say, you know, if I had to do one thing different in our wedding, it would be the wedding vows. And I think we were young and I was new in my faith. And when I go back and watch the video and I see the very explicit roles that were laid out, you know, you're to submit to your husband and he's to be the leader and you're to be the homemaker and he's to be the financial provider. I would do that very differently today, you know. Interesting, I think a lot of people see our marriage as traditional because I did actually stay home for like, I don't know, until Madison went to kindergarten.
It was hard.
Yeah, that was hard staying home.
You did super heavy lifting, you know, three kids, three and under for like 10 years you were home and it's not your normal.
It's not my gifting.
Wiring. Mm-mm. I mean, when you were growing up, you got punished. It was stay in the house and do housework.
Right. So cook and clean and decorate.
Oh,
somebody cut my fingernails off. Yes. I love the relationship of mothering. I don't like everything else that goes with mothering when you're a stay-at-home mother, because then you might as well do the cleaning. You might as well do the cooking, right? You're home, which is why I did the cooking for 30 years. It made sense. I was home, you know?
Right.
But people, when they look at us, they actually think we have a traditional marriage, which is because you've been kind of the financial provider. I've kind of been the second when it comes to financial providing. I did stay home with the kids. Do you think we have a traditional marriage?
I mean, in some ways, I mean, you know, we raised the kids, we had dinner at 5, blah, 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 went to church on Sunday. I think that's somewhat traditional. But I mean, I've never had a traditional bone in my body. So it never even occurred to me that you should stay home no matter what, you know. You had gifting and talent and it was like, yeah, let's make that soar. And I think our kids have been a part of that. And it's just been part of how we do life. I think that's traditional marriage for a lot of people, but it's not necessarily traditional marriage for a lot of the church world that we were in,
mm-hmm.
where women are looked down on for actually working outside the house and that kind of thing. So, and we have wide open conversations. We make decisions, you know, equally. Nobody's in charge.
In fact, two of us are both in charge, and sometimes it's a lot of being in charge.
Yeah, I don't think it's. Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it gets a little intense, but in general, it's worked out quite well. So
yeah,
I wouldn't want anything else.
Yeah, interesting. It looks like we have a traditional marriage, and what you said, in some ways, we absolutely do. And yet, like, I've been married to you for 37 years, and I've never once, like, there isn't a bone in your body that has an idea about roles. Like, that's just never how you functioned. And
I'm better at cooking and cleaning, I can tell you.
Yeah. Well, I'm better at not spending money.
That's true. Yeah, that is true.
Reversed roles right there.
Is it?
Oh, the assumption is the woman always spends the money.
No. No, that's not true.
No, not true. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting, right? Like, I think people see something, and in my mind, I'm thinking, you don't get it. I don't think my husband has ever indicated in any way that I was second, less than. If I wanted to be the provider and I had the capacity to do that, you would have been for it. If I could have been the breadwinner, I think you would have been fine with that. You would have been fine if I stayed home or not stayed home. You know, yeah, it's interesting. I want to move on to something different. And let me add a little history here. You know, we're talking about marriage, and that has been the dominant model for humans since the inception of humanity. But we do see a little bit of a shift in the early church. First, we have to take note that Jesus wasn't married, and nor was John the Baptist, nor was Paul. And Jesus didn't seem to hold on to the Roman ideal of marriage and family. Now, remember, he was born and raised underneath Roman context, right? Where Augustine was really hammering the idea of laws for family and marriage. And he does something very different. Like, I always think about Dobson. I don't know where Dobson got his ideas, because Dobson could have never interviewed Jesus, because Jesus said things like, "Who are my mothers and brothers?" And then he looks around at everybody in the room who are not his actual blood family and says, "Here are my mother and brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother, sister, and mother." Which, by the way, take note, audience, he doesn't put a father in that sentence. The father's not in the family. You know why? Because the father is God now. It is not the male authority in Rome. Fascinating. And many of the early Christians, like, they moved when they converted to Christianity, they started to embrace this idea of celibacy, even in marriage. So, like, this is what Paul is addressing in 1 Corinthians 7, 3 and 4, where he says, "The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body," which right there, that statement, that verse is usually what's quoted in scripture, not the whole verse, just that verse, right? We're telling our wives to have sex with the men. "And the wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife." Again, the thing in culture that was like a, "Whoa, what are you saying here, Paul?" is the idea that he does not have the right to withhold his own body from his wife. She had no say. Of course, she couldn't withhold her body. Anyway, the point being is that in Corinth, what was happening is early Christians were converting, and some of them were married. And what they were saying was like, "Oh, celibacy is like the highest level of spirituality. And so I will stay married, but stop having sex with my mate and become celibate." And Paul's like, "No, no, no, no. If you're not married, that's great. Stay single. And if you are married, stay married. Basically, have sex in your marriage." So we see this idea of celibacy starting to rise in the early church. Part of that is because when Constantine becomes the emperor and he makes Christianity legitimate, martyrdom loses its spiritual symbolism, right? It used to be if you were a martyr, you were kind of the most spiritual in the faith, except now nobody's getting persecuted. So celibacy kind of takes place of martyrdom, right? It becomes like this symbol of like a higher status of spirituality. And so we see this happening in the early church. We see our church father, one of our first church fathers, Origen, he actually cut off his private parts so that he could be celibate. By the way, he regretted that decision later and he wrote about that.
No kidding.
Whoops, I got a little radical too quickly there. We have St. Jerome in 325 who says, "Marriage pollutes the earth and virginity populates heaven." And then we see celibacy rise again in the Middle Ages. And around the 1100 AD, we see where priests start to take vows of celibacy that have continued on today. And women started going into monasteries. And that was often because they wanted to study and learn. And they couldn't do that in any other way other than to like get out from underneath marriage and be able to like go to school, which would be a monastery. So this takes me to the issue of sex, because Christians have always...
Yes.
Please get there. Hurry.
Kindly.
Christians have always struggled to make sense of the act of sex, haven't they? I mean, we have our early church fathers argued over whether or not the acts of sex happened prior to or after the fall. Did you know that was a big theological debate?
I think it was happening all the time.
Gregory of Nyssa said that the creation was sexless, and St. Augustine said it was present in the beginning, but however, quote unquote, the sex act was tainted with lust. In the 13th century, we have Thomas Aquinas, who said women are sexual animals and men just want to reason. We've just not known what to do with marriage and this idea of sex. So let's talk about sex. And I'm just going to put the statement out there like that and let you share whatever you want to share, Steve.
No, you don't want, you don't really want me to do that.
Sure I do. Fire away, okay. Baby.
Well, first of all, it's another one of those areas. I just don't get why people get so wound up about it. Obviously, we are created to have sex. All beings have sex. It's pleasurable. Why does it have to be an issue? You know, why can't it be a robust and plentiful and joyful experience in a marriage? And, you know, I've always taken the challenge, I guess, of I should be a learner all the way through, you know, 37 years in, I should be better at it than I was 37 days in.
And you are.
Yeah. Well, and I've worked at that, you know, and it is my joy to please you as my wife. And I just think that sex is a robust part of marriage. And there's times when it has been, there's more space. You know, we had three little kids and you're exhausted and
been touched all day long and didn't want to be touched anymore. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are times there where I would be frustrated that, you know, our frequency was down or whatever, but I don't think it's ever been a major issue in our relationship. I just think it's been something we embraced as part of marriage and part of something we enjoyed and something to seek and have fun with and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I don't know if you're saying, do I have any advice? I don't know that I have advice except that it's a normal part of life and it should be robustly embraced in marriage. And I think it is difficult that people, and I shouldn't say a thing. I know a lot of marriages struggle because of teachings they were given as Christians about sex.
Right.
I don't know why. Of course, I was kind of rebellious always through the church years anyway, so I didn't pick up any of those teachings, but it's unfortunate. And I think that if we've spent a lot of time with people individually or together in pastoral roles, it's been these issues of sex have been a significant part of why we're meeting with folks. And oftentimes people bring some very strange thinkings that they were trained with or that they have somehow burrowed into their heart and these guilty feelings, all kinds of things, instead of just embracing, you know. I think we've always been equally matched too. So, we can't speak to some people have different libidos. And so that's a different thing to walk through in life, et cetera. But I'm convinced if sex can be embraced as pleasurable, enjoyable, something to be worked on, something to get better at, all those kinds of things, it can be a good part of marriage.
Right. I like what one person said one time to me. She goes, look, sex is like three different types of restaurants. Sometimes it's a drive-through. You're picking up a taco on the way in, out, you're done, you know? Sometimes it's a meat and potato meal, you know? And sometimes it's a five-course meal at a French restaurant. And, you know, like, that's a good way to look at it. It's, you know, but what I hear you saying is it's a part of marriage. You and I would probably agree. It's not like some, like your sex life. It's just a part
of. It's not a separate thing.
It's not a separate thing. It's a part of, right? And it takes work. Mm-hmm. I think you and I have done a really good job overall of talking about it, which is hard because it's a very vulnerable thing, right? Like, but we've done.
Well, I think you brought that to the marriage. I mean, I think my Christian upbringing would, one thing I did maybe learn and take on is you don't talk about these things, you know, you don't talk about fantasies, you don't talk about bad thoughts, you don't talk about, you know, you just fight all that stuff. So I think the fact that you've been like, let's talk, let's be humans has brought a lot of freedom for us.
Yeah.
And that's been good.
Yeah.
Super helpful.
And again, just the communication and the work, right?
Absolutely.
It takes work. Yeah. And there are seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're now in our, you know, empty nest season. We don't have kids running around. We're not exhausted like we were. Like there's different seasons, right? For women's bodies and for men's bodies. And then also we, you know, you and I have done a lot of counseling where with over sexual issues with couples. And, you know, the other thing that comes into play here is sexual abuse. And we know that one out of four women have been sexually violated in their lifetime. And that affects a marriage. You know, it affects everybody. And we're not even discussing that men also have experienced sexual abuse. And so there's lots of dynamics, but man, we got to talk and talk and talk and keep at it, you know.
But, you know, this goes back to something you said earlier. And I had said something about, you know, I really missed the pain and the struggle that you had with my mom and how she was treating you, et cetera. And I guess what I wanted to say to that is I think sometimes guys want to have great sex life, but they want to skip the emotional life, the taking time to invest in what they might consider frivolous. You know, how are you feeling about this and all that kind of thing. And I think that's all part of intimacy.
Right.
That is often skipped.
Yeah.
But
a lot of women
we haven't lacked any communication and intimacy in our marriage because, my God, that just didn't exist. I mean, I think our first breakfast, I opened the newspaper and got ready to have my coffee. And all of a sudden, this hand just went through the air like a big hook and snatched the newspaper. I'm like, what are you doing? You go, well, what are you doing? We're going to have conversation. And we've had conversation over coffee 365 days, 37 years since.
It's true. It's true. Some of your friends are like, oh, my God, that sounds like hell.
Sometimes it is.
Sometimes it is.
Not very often.
All right. So let me move us on. So we have, you know, the Roman laws that come into place. We have what's happening in the early church. Then we have the medieval or Middle Ages. And during the Middle Ages, there's like a power vacuum that happens. And this is really when we start to see priests and ministers move into the area of marriage in a way that had never been done before. So we start to see in the 11th century where bishops would be asked to come after the wedding ceremony to bless the couple, and they would. And then we saw people go, oh, well, this is a lot on the priest. Why don't we just have the ceremony outside the church? And so we started having communities come to the church building, and he would bless it after the ceremony. And then before we know it, in the 12th century, we have this wedding ceremonies happening inside the building and being officiated by a religious leader. Right, priest, minister. And finally, in 1563, at the Council of Trent, the church declared that all Christians who wish to have a valid and sacramental marriage must be married in the presence of a priest and two witnesses. I won't even go into why. Well, no, I will. We also see the government get involved. And the government gets involved because the parents start to lose some control. We have the Enlightenment that happens a little over 200 years ago, and John Locke's thinking about individuality. And we start to see children, women and men, start to try to make decisions about their mates without their parents' permission. And the parents sense that they're losing some control. So what they did was they went to the church and they went to the government and they said, we need this to be legalized so that we have some say. And so part of the reason, it's not the only reason, that something is never that simple, but one of the reasons our governments are involved is because parents still wanted control over who their children married. That parental prenuptial control that parents had, they lost grip of that about 200 years ago. And we start to see at that point where women and men begin to wrestle the control for the right to marry out of the hands of the parent. And in the last 100 years, and that might be being even too generous, 100 years, women have had the independence to make marital choices without having to bow to economic and social pressure. You and I have a lot of close friends that are not married, and many of them that have never been married. And the church, you know, they've gone to church with us and done life with us, a faith life with us, and they've communicated how they felt treated like second-class citizens. And I was really mindful during the pandemic when our life got really quiet. It was just you and I home a lot, you know, and I realized how much we needed a ton of people in the middle of our marriage to help us stay healthily married, right? I need a lot of socializing, and so do you. And so you wanted me to share some of myself with other people, didn't you, Steve?
And there are times when you just need somebody else to talk to. Yeah.
And so, yeah, they make our marriage, right? So just interesting. So let me ask you this question. What do you think you've gained? Here we are 37 years in. What did you gain? What didn't you have that you now have because of our marriage?
Self-confidence, understanding of myself, freedom to think and talk about dark sides of me and not see them as, you know, like these heavy weights that are weighting me down. Lack of boredom. I mean, I really don't think we've had really a boring moment.
No, I can't be bored. It's just, there's no being bored with Steve.
No. Well, I'm just saying we haven't, you know, we generally talk in the morning, we talk in the evening, we go do things together, et cetera. Self-confidence is a pretty significant one.
What do you mean by that?
Just that I can do well. And if I don't do well, I'm not going to fall into the abyss. I have a loving wife to be there to walk through that and to catch me. And but also, you know, you're very good at encouraging and seeing attributes that need that are good and encouraging those. I think, you know, that we have shared similar visions about life and how to do life has created a real comfortable space that has made life very fulfilling. You know, it's not like I've had to give up a ton to be married to you, as far as I can, you know, as far as I can tell.
As of yet.
Maybe. I gave up a lot of hours to conversation, but... But you know, I think marriage has created just a maybe a web of safety.
That's a nice way of saying it, a web of safety. Yeah, I think, you know, someone asked me was, do you think your spouse should be your best friend? And I was like, I don't really know about all that. But I think marriage has given me the permission to be myself. You use the word dark. I would use my shadow self, which we all have a shadow self. That's a Christian term to assume that it's dark, right? It's this part of you that if you brought all of you forth, somebody would be scared of what some thoughts you had or some things you might be thinking of, you know, all of that. We all have them, right? So we all have a shadowed self and we hide that shadow because, oh my gosh, you know, like if somebody really knew, I wouldn't be accepted. I wouldn't be loved. And so in this marriage anyway, that has not been the case, right? There has been freedom. I do know, and that's not normal. I do know that a lot of people have to hide themselves in different ways.
Yes, absolutely. And we've talked about everything.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that, you know, there. What I would say, you said the word safe, and I said the word for me would be belonging. I feel accepted, and I feel like I belong, like home. You know, in many ways, you're my home. Not where we live. But you.
No, I'm your tomato soup made with milk.
You are your, that's right. So, you know, in the past 50 years, what's changed about marriage, and it's probably 50 some years, but we're going to just say 50, it's probably 50 plus. But for the first time in history, marriage has been about love. It's been about trying to find a soulmate. And that's a very, very new concept.
Right.
And I think
people don't realize that.
Right. It's, and I'm not saying that people who were married throughout history never loved each other. A lot of people grew into love, but they didn't marry for love and they weren't looking for their love or their soulmate. So what do you think about this whole soulmate thing? Because that is something that's sometimes communicated in the church. Like if you can, when you find the one, all things will come together and Cinderella will happily live ever after.
Right, right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there is a sense when you meet the one that you've found like the person. But we know for a fact that if I died or you died and we were, you know, over several years to meet somebody else, we can find another person that we can enjoy life and adventure and sex and everything with. So obviously there's not just one, or people would never get remarried, you know. Also, I mean, we grew up, we were in the same hometown.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure if when my dad retired from the Air Force in California, we didn't move to New York. If we had stayed in California, I would have met somebody in California.
Right.
And I would have been happily married. So, yeah, I think that there's like one soulmate is an odd concept. I think it's romantic. I think it's, you know, movie, wonderful. But it's probably not helpful.
It could even be dangerous and damaging, right? Like I'm waiting for my soulmate, the one and only, right?
Yeah.
That's a heck of a lot of pressure to put on an individual to be your soulmate. And you and I have had these conversations not only with each other, but also with our kids. I mean, when one of our children a few years back broke up with someone that I think they thought they would marry, I talked to them and said, hey, you do know there's other people out there. And they were like, yeah, I know there's no such thing as just one person, Mom. And I was really glad that we had established, because I think there's a panic in the church, particularly for women, about finding this right one, you know, this one and only. What if I can't find the one and only in the haystack, you know?
And your youth leaders and all those people have been praying for the one and only.
The one and only. You know,
Yeah.
Lots of
pressure.
If you
don't get the one and only, you missed the prayer.
You've missed it, man. You've missed it.
That's crap.
Yeah.
I do think over time, we become more soulmates.
Yeah.
Because you've shared a lot and you've grown a lot and you've helped each other through ups and downs and all that kind of stuff. So I think you can find another person, but I think soulmate is more about what you create over years than something that you discover.
Right. And we could use other words like that.
I just came up with that, but that's pretty damn
good. That was really good, honey. Yeah. See, that was all those morning coffee talks that brought that about. That. Woohoo! You go, brother. So we asked a couple of our friends, you know, what are some things they would say that make a good marriage? And it was fascinating because one of them responded that it takes creative problem solving, that it takes active listening, that it takes making it okay to feel a certain way, even if you're a man. It takes tenacity. And it was interesting because none of the answers that we got from our friends when we asked them, did they say it's all about love, right? Which was interesting. Now, that doesn't mean love isn't a factor, but it wasn't like that was the sole thing. So here you are now. We started talking about your parents, and I want to go back to ending this close to like talking about your parents, because your parents are now in their late 80s, early 90s, and they're in a very different mm-hmm. stage than like your whole mm-hmm. upbringing. And mm-hmm. So how does their marriage, share a little bit about where their marriage is at right now and how that's informing you about how we're going to move forward.
Oof. Yes. I mean, it's my parents have always had, they've had for them a fabulous marriage. And they weren't, I don't think, as great at communicators as they could have been, but who am I to say? I mean, kids always have different opinions, but they, you know, I learned a lot from my dad. He was very faithful. He didn't go to bed angry. He stayed in the game on things, et cetera.
He adored your mom. He has always adored your mom.
What I did learn from him and didn't do is nearly the kind of job he did is he absolutely 100% held a very firm line to the kids always showing respect to mom. So, you know, now he's 90 and my mom is, you know, losing some of her memory and kind of a downer. That's why I didn't know how to say it. I mean, she's always saying, I didn't know God was going to let me live this long. It's not easy. Living long is not for the faint of heart. And she's not easy.
And a lot of that has to do with dementia.
All that kind of stuff. But it's very much my dad, too. He's daily rowing and rowing and rowing. And, you know, he's saying things that I'm not used to hearing him saying, like, I've shed a few tears or I've had some down days and that kind of thing. But I mean, the truth is, when you say for better or worse, I mean, this is one of those moments. This is not an easy time. I'm sure they have some nice moments here and there. But in general, I think it's a difficult time. And
the difficulty has been a couple years. It's not.
It's been a long time. It's tough.
Yeah.
And they're doing it really well. My dad's doing it really well. But the other thing I've learned from it, though, is because they're somewhat isolated and they've kind of lived a very independent, you know, we can take care of ourselves kind of life. I don't want to wind up in that place. You know, I do want to have friends and family close by who can intervene and come by and have a cup of coffee or watch a football game or something to just break up the monotony of those moments. And I don't think they get that. Mm-hmm. I know they don't get that. Yeah. And I think that's tough.
Yeah. I think one of the things we've observed is that, you know, they grew up in a time frame in which it was about leaving and cleaving. And it's just you and your husband. You are now the, what do you call that? The nuclear, right?
Yeah, but they both came from, you know, marriages that were not, they were kind of loveless. My dad's was actually, you know, they had an abusive relationship with his parents.
So you're saying they both came from parental marriages that were not healthy?
No, they weren't really. Right. And so they were really determined to make something new. And I think they made it too independent.
Right.
But, you know, who am I to say? I mean, I don't know what it took to create what they did, but I don't want that to be our future.
Right. We're recognizing how important community is in the last decade of your life. And it can be a huge difference in how you go toward the other side. Mm-hmm. But I have admired, and I know you have too, your dad is your mom's sole caretaker. He's 90 years old. He's the only one caring for her day in and day out. They live together in their own apartment, and he is staying in the game, rowing every day. And it's very admirable. So this idea of marriage based on love and companionship, one of the things I want to stress is that's a break with thousands of years of tradition. But babe, I do love you. I love you to the moon. And I love that we have written a story together. We have created history together. And when I tell people, you know, that we've been married 37 years, they're like, oh my gosh, that's so long. Congratulations. And I was like, no, really the thing that's the real wow is that I'd still choose you all over again. I like the way we make history together. Over the past 37 years, you have periodically written me poems. Roses are red, violets are blue poems. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it would be appropriate to end this episode with one of those poems. So
I got to make up a roses are red, violets are blue poem on the spot.
You do.
Oh my God. Let's see.
No pressure.
Roses are red, violets are blue. Rehearsing and reviewing our marriage makes me love you more. Wait a second. That's not working out. Right. See, you can't put me on the spot like that.
Try it again, baby.
I'm at a blank here. Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm so glad that I found you.
Ooh, thank you, honey. All right, everybody. I hope you have enjoyed learning more about the history of marriage. I hope that maybe helps you understand a little bit more about your own. And I don't know, maybe you had some fun listening to Steve and I. And hey, if you want to share some of your interesting nuggets about marriage, I'd love to hear it on our Facebook group, Jackie Always Unplugged. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.